Okay, let's have some interactive fun this hour. Phone calls, whistleblower questions. Linda Moulton Howe with us on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, a lot of people on the East Coast over the last couple of days have been concerned about some boom sounds they've been hearing. I think the official word is jets, but who knows? Have you heard anything about that?
Yes, I got calls and emails. Oh, gosh, they've been coming in daily, but I think it was about 6 o'clock my time that I had a voicemail from somebody about Maryland, and the voicemail was there was a huge boom heard throughout the entire state of Maryland. That was the voicemail. And then I heard from John Burroughs and from Race Hobbs that there was information coming that there was New Jersey had some shaking with a boom. And at first, the first news reports were that there had been a seismic event. But a couple of hours later, that had been replaced by the seismic USGS saying there was no seismic event, and the Air Force bases saying they had nothing in the air that could explain it. Plus, if you have a sonic boom, you're not going to hear that over the entire state of Maryland or the entire state of New Jersey. And we're talking about widespread shaking, the ground shaking, huge boom sounds. This has been going on since January of 2011. That's where it began for me and all of my Earth Files reports. And in January of 2016, the reports have been coming almost as rapidly and intensely as they did last year. I had 15 states between January 1 and January 30th. And so there is a cycle to this phenomena, and it involves tremendous compression. There's lots of houses where the owner, I've talked with them, and they say it is like something shook the entire house. That is like a compression wave. Well, if the compression wave is coming from above onto the house and causing the shaking, how do we explain simultaneously that sidewalks have cracked? There has been ground motion coming up. It's almost as if there is something that is impacting from both the atmosphere and from below ground. And anybody listening who is a firsthand ear witness, whether it's New Jersey, Maryland, or any place else, who could let me know, send an email to earthfiles@earthfiles.com. I am trying to work my way through all of the communications that I'm getting to hear people who have had firsthand, because it's very important. Some people have the sense that it is coming from below ground, others from above ground, and then there have been several reports now in January of people who have heard a very bizarre hum. We're back into that again, more of the metallic hum. So something, George, is going on.
It sure is. What an amazing planet, an amazing universe, isn't it?
No.
Scientists continue to look for things, finding things. It's crazy. What are you hearing these days, Linda, about the oceans and too much fish being taken? Have you looked into that?
It has been an ongoing and growing problem for a long time, where there have been treaties or agreements to try to curtail certain kind of fishing, and then you will get, let's say, in the Asian countries, they say no, that they're dependent. And I think that we are fishing out lots of marine life, such as sharks and tuna, and the list is quite long. And the other thing that I think that people don't realize, because it is complex, but it is the ocean waters. We're on a planet, two-thirds of it is water. And the oceans have been absorbing CO2 and other atmospheric gases for a very long time, which has been slowing down warming. But in the process of doing all that absorption and the ocean waters getting warmer, which they definitely are right now in the Pacific, what has happening is that there are chemistries, acidic chemistries, that are increasing in the ocean waters. You've heard about what happens to the shells of shellfish, that they are completely eaten away and they die. Well, there are other changes that are happening as the water are getting warmer, and I'm going to be doing an Earth Files report very soon on the common moors that are up in the Alaska Gulf. Just in January, this is kind of hard to comprehend, this is a fact, on the Whittier Beach, one beach, I think it was January 7th, the USGS Wildlife Service, they counted an estimate of 8,000 birds all dead.
Jeez.
At the same time. And one of the biologists said, this is unprecedented, and even went so far as to say, this has gone way over and beyond anything that anybody has ever heard before. And here is an interesting analysis. Currently, this is the analysis of why this is happening at such a huge rate right now. They estimate over 100,000 of these common moors have died just since, I think, October. And Jeez. What is right. paralleling these deaths is that where we used to have east-west flow in the air across North America, it has been changing as we get into the fall and the winter, that it's going on a north-south vector. And in fact, the metaphor was used in several of the reports I've been reading, that the air has changed so much with the jet stream coming down in an oscillating pattern as it has for the last 2 or 3 years consistently. And as the jet stream comes down in these big waves, it sets up these whirls of moist air and literally is pushing or sucking the birds into a kind of vortex that's now being set up by north-south directions of the air. And the birds are weakened because all of this air has changed, the water temperatures have changed, some of the food that the birds ate are now going further north or someplace else. So the birds were weakened by not having enough food. And then we have gigantic wind changes. And one observation was, just in the last 4 months, that there were a whole bunch of these moorbirds. They literally were pushed by these strong winds that are being affected by the oscillating winds as they're going north-south, and that the birds ended up going completely over the mountain ridge that is in Alaska, where on the other side of the mountains, it's tremendously colder than it is in the Alaska Gulf. So all of this turbulence has to do with changes in the global climate, the redistribution of wind forces, warmth, cold, and it means then that the birds, not only are they dying because of what is happening with the winds pushing them into places where they can't get food, but they aren't getting the food that they used to get, even in the Alaskan Gulf. And when you realize that this is unprecedented, no biologist, nobody has any precedent of 8,000 of these birds on one beach. There have been die-offs, but it's becoming wider spread, more intense, because the whole food distribution is changing with the changes in the winds and where marine animals are moving away from where they used to be. It's serious.
Yeah, it sure is. All right, to the phones now. Let's go to Bill, truck driving in Virginia, to get us started. Hello, Bill.
Yeah, hello. Hey, great report tonight. I like the contrast between the orthodox science of the ninth planet and the unorthodox research into extraterrestrial intelligence.
So
really great contrast.
I think the second part is just as valid as the first myself.
Oh, yeah, and you really drew a lot of good, as a matter of fact, it was one question you drew out of the scientists I want to comment on. When you asked them about the ancient Sumerian text and, you know, their observations of stellar phenomena, and he said that they would have had to have been visited by an extraterrestrial intelligence. You know, it kind of made me laugh, because I was thinking, scientifically, all matter interacts and is interrelated. Okay, so I'm wondering if he hinted at all to you offline, if this, if the revolution of this ninth planet in our solar system could perturb or disrupt anything that could possibly lead to an impact. Because we know asteroids, I just passed over the Chesapeake Bay, that's an asteroid crater. We know bolides have struck the Earth in the past. Did he hint around about, you know, a possibility of the ninth planet doing anything like that?
No. I asked him in that interview very specifically, what is the closest that this object that is still gravitationally impacting, it hasn't been seen physically, but it has to be 10 times the mass of our Earth to have the impact on those 13 bodies, including Sedna. The closest that this orbit would bring this, let's assume it's a big gaseous planet like Neptune, is 7 astronomical units beyond Neptune. This is an object that is largely in the mid-Oort cloud. This is where I used that phrase, that how far is this, that we are talking about basically billions of miles from the sun, and it's Neptune. Here it is. He has discovered what might be a gaseous planet similar to Neptune, and that it is 7 times the distance from Earth to Neptune, and that is 19,565,000,000 miles from our sun. It is never going to come toward, get even close to Pluto. And when I ask him about the whole issue of could there be any influence on our solar system, he says only Neptune has less than 1% basically, and that this will never, from his point of view, it's never going to have any direct influence on our solar system, where the inner planets are for sure. And that the gravitational impact that it is having on Sedna and those other 12 bodies, they are out at the area that would be between the Kuiper Belt and the Oort Cloud. So this is a long distance, sort of like the big, big, big tail at the end of the chain leading to the sun, but it is far, far away.
I think old Pluto should be a planet, don't you?
Well, it's with its heart beating, so to speak, bless its heart. But I understand Professor Brown's point of view, that if you find something like Eris or Iris, people pronounce it differently, and it is larger than Pluto, and it is still categorized as a dwarf icy planet, and it's larger than Pluto, then Pluto doesn't deserve to be called a planet. It deserves to be called an icy dwarf planet, which is what happened. And now we've got this thing 10 times the mass of the Earth. That is definitely in a planet category, even if it's all gaseous like Neptune. So you can see that the astronomers like to have things measured and analytical. And if we have a cutoff of a certain size that is a planet, poor old Pluto still is an icy dwarf.
Next up, let's go to our Skype caller, John in Milwaukee. Hey, John, thank you. Go ahead.
Well, hello, George. Hello, Linda. How are you both?
Hi, John. Good.
Hello.
Well, you know, I was doing some thinking about all this stuff about UFOs, and over the years I've heard a lot about the visual aspect of UFOs, and also the idea of the downloading into people's heads, and I'm a firm believer that all that is true. However, I wonder, too, if there isn't something to the idea of any auditory signals because, you know, being a blind person, I'm very in tune with my hearing. And there have been times that I'll be sitting outside or I'll even be sitting here with the window open during the summer, and I will hear these noises that, well, no pun intended, they are just out of this world. You know, it's
like, do you mean hums or booms or metallic sounds or what?
Sometimes they're very strange hums. I've heard, like, there was like almost a whirring hum, almost a higher pitched, eerie whirring hum. You know, almost what you would, the best way to put it is almost what you would hear sounding like a fictional spaceship, but not quite. It's its own frequency, for lack of a better word.
Well, often, at least when we're dealing with this technology, people who hear something usually also get images placed in their mind, sometimes with symbols. Have you ever had communication that was either telepathic word or image with symbols?
Are you still there?
I am.
Yeah.
I'm still here. I missed what was said there.
What I wondered is, when you were listening and you could hear the sounds and you don't see, but you hear, have you ever had what you thought were pictures or images placed in your mind while you were hearing unusual sounds, and or any symbols or thought words?
I have, you know, and I wasn't sure if I was having a psychic vision or not, because I do readings for a living. So, you know, it was, you know, it definitely left me wondering, okay, what is this? You know?
What were the nature of the images?
One was particular back in 2008, roughly in August, September. I saw the stock market crash before it even happened. And I remember sometime later, after I made the prediction, after hearing the noises, a friend of mine came to my house and said, "You were right. It happened just the way you said it would." And I was like, whoa. I mean, it was clear as day. I saw every detail of it. It just blew my mind.
Curious, Linda, because you're onto something. Why you would ask that question? It sounds like it's come up before, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've interviewed about 1,500 people by now in the human abduction syndrome, and one of the things that I always try to ask about is whether it's sounds or light, that the interaction with the intelligence that we're dealing with, it is placing images in human minds, often overlaid with symbols. Sometimes the symbols are gold. They're often the person who's having the interaction has the impression that they're looking at hieroglyphs or some kind of a language that is superimposed over the streams of images that come quite fast. And often, while all of that is happening, people will also be getting thought words. The thought words are telepathic.
Yep, they just plant them right in the brain. We'll be back with more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast, of course, we're going to have open lines on Friday night into Saturday morning, but we're also going to talk about dogs and being buried alive. That's right, on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, our final segment with Linda Moulton Howe. Linda, what is your presentation going to be up there at Big Bear Lake?
Well, on Friday night, I am doing a presentation that I'm calling the taxonomy of ETs, because there has been both whistleblowers, documents, much more what I call hard substantive information about different types. There is a fascinating document that includes a breakdown for President Ronald Reagan, other things that I feel right now that we can take what the abductees have said, we can take what are out as whistleblowers, and we can take some documents. I try to put it together synthesize and say this at least is the beginning of a working taxonomy on what we're dealing with, and that out of everything that we know, there is nothing that is a threat except maybe one. And if there are allies, then maybe that is why humans are doing pretty well in technology.
Let's go to Mike in West Palm Beach, Florida, to get things started in this segment. Michael, good morning.
How you doing?
Good, Mike.
I'll tell you my feeling. I have total contempt for astronomers. Total contempt.
How come? Tell me.
I don't believe anything this guy told you on the air. There was one bit of truth in there. When he sarcastically talked about the aliens giving him ideas about the planet, that was the truth. But otherwise, I can't believe what he's saying. He's telling us that he knows there's something out there. They can't photograph it. They don't know where it is, but they know it's there because of gravity and everything. Meanwhile, his colleagues are screaming that they've identified 2,000 Earth-like planets thousands of light years away because you have a space telescope taking pictures of it. They know the size of the planets, the distances, thousands of light years, but we can't get a picture of this one. He's a liar. My feeling is this. The planet exists, but he got his information. We have advanced space programs and secret stuff going on. We've been out there already, but they can't admit that. So he comes around with a story like he gave us here.
I have to interrupt. Professor Brown is a straightforward, very honest astronomer, and the fact that something is so far away that it is, and it is gaseous, and that means that it may not also reflect light as well as if it were a rocky planet, and that the gravity itself, the gravitational attraction that this big mass has, is what has caused the gathering of those 13 bodies. That's what they first noticed with Sedna. All of that is straightforward astronomy, and that they're going to be looking for motion. That is classic astronomy. And when it comes to faraway planets, no, we're not taking photographs of planets around suns that are light years away. We are making computer observations having to do with whether there's a 1% dimming in the light of that sun, and that is usually indicative, a 1% dim, that there is a planet that is going between the Earth and wherever this sun is. We're not taking pictures of planets. There are all kinds of illustrations, but we're not taking photographs of a planet around a sun that is 45 light years from here. And so we are at a period of time where maybe people get confused that when they hear about all of these Earth-type or Earth-sized planets, we are only being able to determine that by light dimming and factors that relate to that. In our solar system, it is the gravitational attraction of something that's huge out there that has caused this clustering of these objects. And when we talk about Sedna is all the way out to the area between the Kuiper Belt and the Oort Cloud. And this object would be out in the midway in the Oort Cloud, which is billions of light years from where we are now. So the fact that they can't get a photograph of it is not at all unusual. And this is why they're going to start trying to look with the Subaru, which is an excellent telescope, and see now if they focus on a particular area, will they be able to see some kind of motion in light reflection that would still be very, very dim because this is a gaseous planet?
I like his theory that maybe, though, something else is going on with a secret program. What do you think of that?
Not when it comes to this. I think that Professor Brown and the astronomers that he works with, they're the most down-to-earth, straightforward, straight-talking people that you would ever possibly know on this planet. He's interested in our solar system and planets, and he has found so many objects because that's what he likes to do, is look for gravitational changes that might indicate that there is something there, and look what he's been finding. So our solar system is complex, but there's no conspiracy about this mass out there. This is just another one of these unexpected developments in a solar system that long ago, completely independent of Zechariah Sitchin, astronomers have wondered if there were bodies that went out beyond Pluto. And now, in the last 13 years, we have Sedna, we have Iris, we have all of these other bodies, and the very fact that there is this massive Neptunian-type planet out there, as I asked him, how could it get out there so far? He said, we are becoming so aware that there was a lot of banging, crashing, all kinds of stuff was happening in the solar system in the beginning, and that this is probably one of those planets that had an interaction with the area of Jupiter and Neptune. Jupiter is constantly, it's what the astronomers call knocking things out. That gravity and the relationship of orbital mechanics on these bodies could be that this big gaseous planet was closer. And then there were these dynamics going on through the solar system that ended up sort of knocking it out. And when it got knocked out further, it's a big, big gaseous planet like Neptune and Uranus, but it is way, way, way out in the Oort cloud.
How do you balance real science from pseudoscience? Because you're constantly talking to real people, real scientists like these two. And then you're also covering stories of mutilations, and you have your own belief system of extra...
Mutilations are hard physical evidence.
Yeah, but I mean, how do you balance that? Is it difficult?
No, animal mutilations, I'm always dealing with veterinarians and pathologists, and it's hard medical physical evidence. I've got a case right now in England. It is a doozy. This was December 28th, a 19-month-old pony. And this was in Carmarthen, which is in Wales, to the far west, southwestern end of the UK. And Carmarthen has been an area where there have been cycles of bloodless, trackless animal mutilations. The bloodlessness is the characteristic of the last century of what we'll call the large animal mutilations that can also include half cats, domestic, and wild. And in this particular case, this pony, the police and a veterinarian have been involved. And the veterinarian reported to the owner that upon doing a necropsy, opening up the horse, found that the heart, imagine this, you're opening up the horse that has an eye missing. And the heart tissue is dry to touch.
Jeez.
That means that the liquid has been removed from the heart, but how? And
we see that in all the cases, too.
Not all the cases is there even necropsy done. That's rare that necropsies are done, but when they are done, very often internal organs such as bladder or kidney or esophagus have been removed inside of animals with no exterior excision on the surface of the body.
No blood anywhere, nothing.
No, no. These are
amazing.
dry excisions.
Yeah.
And I think what convinced me in 1979, right at the very beginning as director of special projects at the CBS station in Denver, and starting out not knowing the path that I was beginning to step onto, my whole career was in hard medicine and science and the environment. And when Sheriff Tex Graves said that on the very first large animal, that it was a cow, that he went to investigate, and he took a veterinarian with him, and they did a necropsy in the field. This was back, I think it was around 1972 or 73. And the veterinarian looked up at Sheriff Tex Graves and said, my God, there's no heart in this pericardium. Don't ever call me out on another one of these. I am not going to stand up and tell reporters that this is impossible to do. And this was Tex Graves talking to me. And he said, when he realized that this approximately 7-inch by 9-inch by 11-inch tissue in an adult cow was completely missing, the heart was missing from inside the pericardium. The pericardium was collapsed inside the chest of the cow, and there was no cut in the pericardium. There was no clotted blood. That is impossible, but it had occurred, and it has occurred in many places since. We're dealing with phenomena that, for reasons that are not entirely clear, but seem to have something to do with repeated cycles of genetic harvesting in certain latitude and longitude areas over and over again. And that's this horse in England right now. It's being investigated by police. A veterinarian has reported that there was no blood in the heart, let alone nothing at the excision.
Next up, let's go to Tom in the Bronx, east of the Rockies. Tom, go ahead.
So, hi, George.
Hey, Tom.
Hi to your guest. I'd like to say that I knew a undertaker years ago. He was up in years. He had the humor of a cardboard box, I swear. He had said that, you know, the way somebody says, oh, my friend seen this.
Sure.
But they really mean themselves. I swear that he was talking about himself. He was in the Army, I believe. He was at Roswell, New Mexico, if it wasn't his friend, let's say. And he had said that his friend saw the two bodies from the crash that took place, allegedly took place, obviously.
It sure.
There
and
were
he
many
said
crashes,
it was nothing not from
one.
This planet, not at all. The two bodies he had seen.
Did he describe them as small, that typical alien gray?
How did he describe them?
He didn't, we didn't get into actually the description. But he just had said, like, I could see his eyes almost, like, get very intense.
Did you believe him?
He talked about it, huh?
Did you believe him?
I knew the guy, for a bit. He was up in years. I guess he was retired. I don't know whether he's still around anymore. But I personally believe the guy.
Well, that's a big story there. That's amazing stuff, Linda, isn't it?
Well, and the other thing about this is that I think that they were beginning in 47, at least, if not before. They knew that when they took some of these bodies from, there were many crashes. Maybe they were Trojan horse, deliberately done to
Maybe.
Put technology in the hands
Maybe.
Of humans.
Sure.
Whatever the reason, there were many, many crashes, many different bodies.
Very strange, too.
And when they would do a necropsy, as I had a firsthand report, that was at Wright-Patterson, and they had two surgeons that were working on the body, and the one man was asked to watch and make notes. And when they decided how they were going to do a T or a Y cut to begin opening up the chest of this completely, clearly non-human entity on the table, when the scalpel started coming down on what looked like at the beginning, they thought it was skin, but the scalpel wouldn't cut. It literally would not cut. And then they realized that they were dealing with some kind of a very sophisticated suit, like cloth.
Mm-hmm.
It was like the skin of the body of the entity.
Interesting.
And that falls into the category of how many androids that we're dealing with, craft that don't need to have the prime organic intelligence in them at all, and that they have got a lot of androids that are interacting
oh
with humans
God.
And animals.
Look what we're doing with artificial intelligence even now.
Yeah, we're probably copying the ETs.
Could be. Let's see if we have time for one more quick one. Mary in Snowflake, Arizona. Go ahead, Mary.
Yes, thank you, Linda, for your devotion and integrity.
Thank you.
I've had many, many precognitive dreams over the years, and I've recently had two very intense dreams that I don't know if this is relevant to the whole Virginia thing or whatever, but I was in a big building, and there was all these people working, and there was all these TVs lined up against the walls, and suddenly everybody stopped working and looked at all the TVs, and there was this huge crack. That's all I really know or whatever, but there was this large crack, and everybody just stopped, and everybody was glued to the TVs.
A sound?
Yeah, a sound. Huge sound.
Like a crackle sound, huh?
Well, just like some big crack in the earth or something like that, but everybody was absolutely stopped working and just started staring at all the TVs. Everybody was just mesmerized.
Interesting dream. Minute to go, Linda. Is it possible the planet can ever split in two?
Not to my knowledge, unless it would be by some vast technology that had energy that is beyond anything we know. Well, I suppose if you look at the natural cosmos, if a large planetary body collided with the Earth, that is
then
probably,
it'll split it.
That could definitely destroy everything. But the idea of the Earth itself without some sort of an impact like that splitting, I don't understand how that mechanism could be. But Grant, remember, said that the experiencers have been shown that they could take the moon, split it apart in front of the Earth watching, and put it back together to demonstrate that they have that kind of control over matter and that they are not going to let us have a nuclear war.
Linda, we'll see you in about a week in Big Bear Lake, California. And again, full details at coasttocoastam.com. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lottasour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.